Hello and welcome to another episode of the Paul Wood Show. I have a very special guest today I'll introduce in a second. But I want to just quickly chat about this week in disruption and also give you guys a quick heads up on a tool that I've been using for about the last month now, which is X.AI. It's one of these automated AI scheduling tools, and you may have heard of their front person that schedules for you is either Amy or I think it's Amy. Oh, that's the one I use, Amy Ingram. Anyway, it's been very interesting. I would say it's 90% accurate. If people write back, like a buddy of mine wrote back and said, go away, Amy Ingram, and she didn't know what to do with that. But in general, it's been brilliant in scheduling meetings, so much so that I'll have to look ahead a week to understand what meetings I really have on the calendar. So I think this is going to be a tool that everybody should be looking at. I know I've been experiencing more and more bots in customer service, but I think the time may be now for this kind of AI scheduling tool. All right. Welcome back, everyone. I am seriously excited to have my next guest, Chance Patterson, on the show. And Chance and I actually worked together years and years ago, where Chance was my client, and we helped to launch XM Satellite Radio.
Back in the good old days.
Back in the day. So very fun to reconnect with you, Chance. Also, in celebration of spring, we are literally overlooking a nice harbor view in Old Greenwich, Connecticut. And if you hear a little background noise, I apologize, but we just couldn't do this inside.
So. That's right.
Anyway, welcome, Chance.
Thank you so much, Paul. So glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. So, Chance, maybe you've had a really rich career so far. Maybe you could give us a little bit of your background. And I think it's really interesting in particular because you have a mix of not just traditional communications and strategy, but also obviously consulting, legal, and other things. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about how your career developed and Maybe just a few of your favorite moments.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Paul. I feel like it's a bit of a renaissance to be back together with you here after all these years, and exciting. I started my professional career as an attorney. You know, I went to Boston University and hail from the Buckeye State and was practicing law there for several years, ended up moving to D.C., practiced there, and joined KPMG in management consulting. Really got tired of the practice of law. I felt like I liked to talk too much to sit in the library or on the computer and research cases and write briefs, and really became excited about helping companies make big decisions. And in my role as a management consultant, I would help companies decide where to build a factory or a call center or a headquarters. You know, like you're seeing Amazon's headquarters choice being, you know, a big deal in the news.
Absolutely.
I was a guy who would help a company like Amazon make that decision. And so, as it turned out, one of my clients was XM Satellite Radio. And when they asked me to join the company as head of corporate affairs, I said, I love the company. I love the business model. I think it's going to be huge. I just had one question. And the CEO said, what's that? And I said, well, what is corporate affairs? Because I hadn't worked in a company before.
I didn't know
what that term was. And he said, well, it's kind of PR and it's kind of whatever else I asked you to do. Mm. And so that really set my mindset as someone who's a problem solver. You know, just happening to use communications to solve big problems, small problems, challenges for companies. And so I was with XM from launch through our merger with Sirius.
Yeah.
And when we merged with Sirius, I was named head of government affairs for the combined company. So I became the head lobbyist and did that for a while and was recruited over to Discovery Communications.
And before we go there, one quick story. For the listeners is actually when we were going to launch, right?
Yes.
You were going to launch XM. I remember it was, I think our launch day was 9/12/2001. So I remember flying down to D.C. from New York on 9/11 and basically thinking, what a beautiful day, you know, to fly. And then obviously all hell broke loose. And I think I was there for like 2 or 3 days. Interesting communication challenge. I remember we were all sitting around going, oh man, this is unprecedented. What do we do? And I think after some research, we figured out that it was about three to four weeks later, we could probably re-engage with the journalists. Am I remembering that right?
That's right. You know, press completely turned their attention appropriately to 9/11 and the aftermath of it. And, you know, meanwhile, we had raised so much money and it, you know, oriented our entire business around launching satellite radio in the United States. And so it completely blew up our own plans and, you know, really, I think, caused us to focus on what matters in terms of trying to really bring a great experience to people. You know, and with satellite radio, of course, you had access to news. People had a high level of interest in news mm-hmm. and breaking news mm-hmm. and what was happening in the country. So, you know, it was predicated, the service was really predicated on commercial free music. But in those early stages, the news took a huge prominence and appeal for consumers, you know, in our first couple of years of launching the thing.
Yeah.
It was very interesting.
I remember that one other thing, and then I'll move on from XM, but one other thing that was a really interesting challenge from a communication standpoint is you were trying to get people to experience something that didn't yet exist.
You're That's right.
About disruption, right?
Yeah.
So you're painting the picture. I remember the programming director, I can't remember his name.
Lee Abrams?
Yeah, Lee Abrams, right?
Of course.
Big hit, guru in the radio industry. And just to hear him talk about the vision behind each of the channels and programs, right? And how each one had its very unique kind of approach and then obviously related programming, DJs, et cetera. But I remember that was one of the bigger challenges is how you couldn't really do sampling.
That's right.
So it was trying to give a lot of journalists a lot of experiences to kind of get there early, and I think we had some test markets and things like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, we tested the Pittsburgh was actually our main test market. It had an uneven terrain. There was a pretty broad demographic mix of potential customers, and so a lot of elements went into understanding how people would feel about the service and how it would work. Because no one had ever delivered a signal from the ground to a satellite to a moving object. It could be going 5 miles an hour, or it could be stationary. It could be going 70 miles an hour in a car. Mm-hmm. So breakthrough technology. But I think what I remember and what has sat with me today many years later is we weren't selling a technology. There was a massive amount of technology. We made our own chipset that makes the radios work. We commissioned our own satellites, all those things. But what we were selling was an experience, right? We're selling an experience for people. And people have a lot of personal opinions about music. I could ask you, are you more of a 60s, 80s, 90s guy? What's your sort of musical genesis? I could ask you about what kind of news programming you like, what kind of sports you like. And so I think that's still a very important lesson for communicators out there. Yeah. Are you selling a product? Are you selling a technology? Or are you selling an experience?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, great point.
And along those lines, you know, when I went to Discovery to head up communications for their international division, at that time, cable was a mature business in the U.S., and they hadn't done a ton to really have a cohesive message about their international platform, which was the most well-established television platform in the world. I mean, they were in 220 countries. So bringing that all together, singing the same song, talking about the strength and growth opportunities globally, that was so much fun for me. Hmm. And I hadn't traveled extensively internationally before. So learning about how the media works in these different markets in China, in the UK, in South Africa, really added to my own body of experience and skills in a way that was, forever changing me. And when I, while I was at Discovery also happened to join in a partnership with Oprah Winfrey for the Oprah Winfrey Network. And that was the next stage of my career. I joined Oprah, became her publicist, and headed up the launch of the Oprah Winfrey Network and really helping her transition from the daytime show to cable, which was a new world for her, a place she had not broadcast before. And that led me to Chicago, which mm-hmm. we spent 6 years in Chicago, had a magical time. Unfortunately, you know, Harpo was shut down in Chicago and everything was relocated to L.A. And, you know, we really wanted to stay in the Midwest, having Harkin from the Midwest many years ago.
Yeah.
And I joined 2U, which is an online education technology platform company that's done amazingly well. We I took the company public, heading up comms and investor relations for several years. And the joy I felt in helping steer this company that's now allowing for people all over the United States to get a great education without having to quit their job, go to the school that of their dreams without having to move.
So this is the technology, the platform that supports all of these online universities,
that's right.
Technical schools, et cetera?
That's right. So you're the dean of a NYU School of Business.
Yeah.
And you want to build beyond your brick and mortar campus. You would hire 2U to help develop that platform and recruit students and allow your faculty to teach courses online and get the same quality education as if they were in the physical classroom.
Sure.
And again, that was groundbreaking. No one had really done anything like that at scale and with these huge historic brands like Yale and NYU and USC, you know, Berkeley. And to deliver on that and now see it just mushrooming, it's now a thriving company.
Yeah.
And it's really brought higher ed really into the digital age.
Yeah, which is a game changer, right? And
yeah.
I note that when obviously that transformation occurred, it seemed like that was not taken as seriously. Oh, do you have an online degree? Oh, whatnot.
Yeah.
But now there's just such depth, I think, and I think it's a good revenue generator, obviously, but also because you kind of have the IP, right?
Right.
But also, I think in terms of helping people advance their careers,
I
think it's huge. Just a quick observation on that. I was recently in Killeen, Texas, which is a little town outside of Austin, about an hour north, and it's adjacent to the Fort Hood military base. And,
okay.
Working with some people there, and as they, there were 12 people around the table, as they introduced themselves, from the receptionist on up to the most senior people, they were all working on either a master's or graduate degree. And a good chunk of them were online.
That's
so right. It was just fascinating to meet people in a huge university town, for example, and there was such a thirst and also access, I think, to higher education, which is probably, you know, I think going to be a great thing for all of them, but probably just proof of the model you're talking about with the company you're working for.
That's right. I mean, we built a company with the promise that with the right technology and the right level of investment, anyone who is a qualified student should be able to participate in higher education. And it's amazing. I feel like, from a communication standpoint, you know, our biggest obstacle was that skepticism you talked about. People assume that online ed is substandard.
Yeah.
It's not as engaging. People don't learn as well. And so battling against that at every turn and really at the same price level, there's no discount. Whatever you pay as a campus student, you pay online. That was groundbreaking because typically online ed has been discounted.
Yeah.
And so to see it now thriving and really having its story clear for Wall Street and for the media, you know, I just I'm so proud of the team and my time there. And you know, as I continued, I promised my wife that was my last startup.
Mm-hmm.
It ages an old guy like me, and so I really wanted to focus on a different stage in my career where I'm kind of what I would call simplifying my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so today I just work with folks in kind of two categories: people that I like, and for organizations that are doing something that matters, that's making an impact on society as a whole.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really helped me focus on what I want to do and what works best for me and what skills I can bring to the table. And so right now I just have a bunch of interesting clients who are, some of them are entrepreneurs, they have their own startups, some of them are well-established companies, some of them are celebrities and notable public figures, but they're all in the business of making society better and making change in the world and not necessarily in the business of making money. Fortunately, most of them are making money,
right,
so they could afford to pay me, but it's really fulfilling. And
Well, that's great, Chance. And I know we've talked in the past about this idea of doing good, but also within a business environment.
That's right. Right?
And not just a pure kind of CSR philanthropic play.
That's right.
And I know you've used the phrase social enterprise.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, in broad terms, you know, you think of a charity as an organization that's oriented towards a social mission. They're trying to, you know, deal with homelessness or trying to deal with education for children, you name it. There are so many great causes out there, but they're usually funded through donations. They have their hat in hand, and they're completely reliant on those contributions. And so with a social enterprise, you're actually providing a service or providing a product. You're developing a product that's bought and sold in the market, and so you have your own sources of revenue beyond, I mean, I'm sure there are any number of them that will take donations, but you're really trying to make money while you're also...
And the money fuels the mission?
The money fuels the mission, and so these social enterprises, there are a couple of... there's an entity form called a low-profit limited liability company. Mm-hmm. That's a new type of entity that kind of straddles between nonprofits and for-profits, and it allows you to make money, but also put money back into the enterprise to grow it, and you have... The shareholders know that that's the deal. Like, if you're going to invest in a social impact enterprise, you probably won't get the same level of returns, but you'll know that every dollar that you don't get is going back into the cause. Right. And so that's, I think it's highly motivating for people. They feel like they get up every day and they're doing something that matters, and it allows for, I think, innovation. You know, we have clients who are doing things that would not have been possible under a regular nonprofit structure. So, and they have a challenge too, because if you're not in the business of making money, you don't have the leeway to like just rely on your earnings call every quarter to draw press attention and get in the news flow with Reuters and AP and all these other financial outlets. You have to earn your place in the news flow by your merits and creating curiosity. And so I like that challenge, because you kind of have to appeal to the hearts and minds of reporters rather than just the dollar figures. So it's fun.
That's great. So Chance, in terms of structures, I've heard the phrase B Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that similar to what you just talked about?
Yeah, the B Corp it tends to do the same thing. It allows for companies to make money, to make a profit, while focused on a particular cause or benefit. B stands for benefit. Okay. And there's an organization that certifies you as a B Corp. There's a pretty extensive qualification process through your charter and all kinds of submissions you have to make to get B Corp status.
Okay.
So that's really a more formalized thing that's only issued through this entity. A social enterprise or this L3C that I mentioned, the low profit limited liability company, any individual or group can submit for that kind of qualification under their state laws.
Yeah.
It's, I think, almost 40 states now recognize low profit limited liability companies. So if there are exceptions, but I would say in most cases you'd want to go for the L3C.
Yeah. Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, there's a Chance and I have talked about my rants on agencies and how they're changing and the rise of the specialist agency. And there's one that I met with recently that I really like that is a B Corporation, and it's called Scout Comms. They're out of D.C. And basically what they do is they focus and specialize in the veteran space. And all of the work that they do helps to fuel then different veteran service organizations.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting, but they're doing some nice work.
Yeah. It's becoming more and more popular. I think one of the things that excites me about my own timing and really being a part of this movement where wealthy individuals, people just coming out of college, people who are retired, people in the middle of their careers, you know, I think they all share this idea of wanting to do things that matter and really finding their way to use their talents towards something that is important to them, you know?
Yeah.
And not just being limited to serving on a nonprofit board or something where, you know, you can actually make a great living and make change in the world. And so I think this is the new way. I think it's going to become much more common. And I think it gives investors, I think it gives talent, I think it gives government all like a way to work towards a common goal. If it's addressing nonviolence, if it's eradicating homelessness, you name it, there are now ways for you to build businesses to deal with those issues and still make a living. Yeah. It's amazing.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, that's a great intersection of passion, right, and business, because I think we were just talking about Gary Vaynerchuk earlier, but he spends a lot of time talking about follow your passion. And I think if you think about also millennials and youngers in the workforce, a lot of surveys I've seen talk about how whatever organization they're working within, they want to make sure it's got a service element to it. So meaning mission-based, doing something, returning something. So it'd be interesting. It's an interesting concept to think you can build a whole business around that and see that.
That's right.
So it's very cool.
Yeah, and you're seeing many more of these investment funds demand that the companies they invest in have a core belief in a cause and actually are putting money towards it and allowing employees to participate in these things. So I think it's all aligning towards making every dollar count towards not only building your own company, but actually addressing things that need to change in our world.
Yeah.
And that's where I want to live.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Because there's reward that comes with doing good work. There's reward with being successful, but I think it's different when you actually know your work has more meaning and you're actually contributing positively every day.
That's right.
Which is really cool.
Yeah, and I've been in companies, like I would say XM is a company that had a deep passion about what they were doing, but also willing to invest in the community and invest in the future. We built, you know, with my advice, you know, we located the company in a very tough neighborhood of D.C. And back then, you know, sort of post Marion Barry, it was a very scary place to build a company, dangerous neighborhood, but my boss Hugh Panero, our CEO then, you know, he just believed that if you want to deal with these urban issues and create safer neighborhoods, you have to invest in the thing. And now you go there, and it's just a flourishing area near Union Station. I wish I bought a couple properties back then.
Yeah,
but it's just it goes to show you that you can make a huge investment in the company and still do good for a bigger society.
Yeah, that's right. We got a truck going by, so we're just going to pause here for a quick second.
Around.
Okay. Yeah. So we're back. The truck has passed. Goods have been delivered
next door. That's right.
So anyway, we're here chatting with Chance Patterson, and we're exploring a lot of different territories. I want to pivot just a little bit and take a twist on our normal lightning round. Chance mentioned to me a book you recently read that you were impressed by. Can you just share a little bit about that?
Yeah, the book is called Essentialism by Greg McKeown, McKeown. And Paul, I've just found this book to be so helpful for me. You know, I'm one of those guys who historically has tried to hero his way through his career, never turning down a new assignment, taking over teams when an executive leaves an organization, and just kind of trying to eat as much as I could possibly eat to help the company move forward and project manage. And you know, as noble as that sounds, it's actually not a great quality. I found it to be at times very, very stressful. I felt at times I was not doing my best work. And this book really is all about the business of doing less better, Narrow the field of things that you're going to do, but do what you do exceptionally well and move the ball every day towards that excellence, and it's created a discipline in me that I haven't had before, I got to be honest. And so even today, as I'm consulting companies and individuals, you know, I've told folks that as much as I enjoy them and am inspired by what they're doing, I'm not in a place to help you right now, because I do want to limit what I'm doing and do what I do exceptionally well. And a lot of this is inspired by that book. So it's not only for careers. I think it has a lot to say about relationships, friendships. You know, I don't know of anyone who has 40 superb friendships, you know, where they're mining and taking care of their friend and communicating all the time. And so how do you become a great friend to a smaller group of people and really, really invest in that relationship, relationships with your children and your spouse? So it's beyond careers, but I think I would say it's a book worth reading for anyone.
Excellent, excellent. I'll put a link to that in the post as well. And then Chance, just a couple other quick questions. One, I think one of the issues that I'm interested in is resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about having a setback at work or your personal life or whatnot, what are some of the techniques that you use to kind of stay resilient and overcome?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, for me, particularly in the last year or so, getting down to the hard question of what matters is the most important thing. This Essentialism book points to this as well. You know, and for us, one of our children has a difficulty in reading. We had sought a school in Chicago to help him and couldn't find one that would meet what we thought were his needs. And so we decided to uproot and move to the New York area to make sure he had the educational support he needed to become, you know, the person he wants to be. And on one level, you know, as I've talked to friends about it, they can't believe we just, you know, up and left. But in a real sense, it made us take stock in what matters. And I think if you really use that on a daily basis, then a lot of the stuff that you're worried about or the commitments that you might make, you'll examine those things and say, is this my best purpose? Is this really what matters to me? A year from now, is this going to be anything that I can even remember, let alone care about? And you know, let's face it, today in corporate America, you know, it's a different world. You know, people move a lot in jobs, people move a lot in organizations. So as long as you are taking stock in what matters for you, your career, your passion, your family, I think a lot of that becomes super clear if you put it through that lens. And so I encourage anyone to do that. And I'm a better person as I've navigated highs and lows in my career, in my office environment, you know, changing bosses, all these other things. And it still comes back to what matters. And the last thing I'll say about it is, one habit I found for folks who struggle with this, with change, you can't seek validation from all people around you. You can't sit there and wait for somebody to tell you that you're good, or that you're doing a good job, or that you're important, or you're hitting all your performance marks, or you're gonna get promoted soon and make more money. Don't wait for that. You have to take stock and validate yourself every day and say, how do I feel about what I'm doing? How do I feel about how I'm managing my team? How do I feel about how I'm supporting my client? You know, don't seek validation from other people. Don't live at the effect of other people. Do your due. Be your genius, and you'll be fine.
All right. So one of the other things that's been in the news recently is Starbucks and the incident they had and their response to try and do some quick training. I'm just curious, Chance, what's your view of all that?
I love this fact pattern as a lesson for communicators, as a lesson for leaders, for CEOs, and for entrepreneurs, because, you know, the question is, if that incident happened at Dunkin' Donuts, would anyone care about it? Okay? And I would posit that it might get a little bit of news, probably just a local news story for that matter. But the reason is, as much as you would equate Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks, what you have to remember as a communicator is Starbucks isn't in the business of selling coffee. Dunkin' Donuts is, okay? You go to Dunkin' Donuts to buy donuts, you buy a cup of coffee.
Large iced tea, man. Yeah.
And then you leave.
Yeah.
You don't linger. Starbucks is selling not coffee, they're selling an experience, okay? And so the idea of unilaterally removing people from the establishment for whatever reason, justified or not, what you're doing is you're actually imploding the business. You're poisoning exactly what you're selling. You're selling the experience of being in the Starbucks. People hang out at Starbucks for hours at a time. People often just go there, they'll buy one cup of coffee and be there for hours. They'll hold meetings there. So the idea of poisoning that, you know, to me is it's a lesson for the company, because what they've done is they haven't told people what the company does. They haven't told people what the company does, because if they told people what the company does, the other employees in that location should have been diving to confront their manager or whoever this person was and saying, that's the one thing you can't do. You can do anything. Mm-hmm. You can do anything. You can make a crappy cup of coffee. You can give people the wrong order. You can do anything. But the one thing you can't do is kick anyone out. Mm-hmm. You can't kick anyone out of here, because that's what we're selling.
Yeah.
And so I think that's how I view that situation. And really what they're doing is, what has happened is they've violated the trust. Okay. Mm-hmm. Everything that we're doing as communicators, as leaders, dealing with customers, dealing with your staff, dealing with your boss, is based on this notion of trust. Okay? Because if you don't trust someone, you're not going to buy anything from them. If you don't trust them, you're not going to work for them. If you don't trust them, you're not going to be a supplier for them.
Yeah.
And Starbucks has broken the trust, and I admire their effort to quickly intervene and be very visible in dealing with the situation, you know, but you work so hard to create that trust and it can vanish in a day. I mean, that's what's happened with Facebook. I mean, they had the trust of the world, at least, you know, much of the industrialized world, and clearly they forgot
that
trust matters. And so when you lose that, you know, you compromise the whole thing. So it's an important lesson to remember as you're leading, as you're recruiting, as you're continuing to make decisions about the business. I think you really have to look at everything from the perspective of, if I invest in this thing over here, or if I partner with this organization over there, or if I do this thing, am I either enhancing the trust of the business, or am I compromising it? And so when you have that rubric in mind, these decisions become rather simple at times.
Yeah. Well, that's great perspective, Chance. I hadn't heard that particular take on it. And the other thing it reminds me, it's good for everybody listening, is what's your brand experience, right? You can have this lofty goal. You can put out this beautiful marketing communications, everything else. But if at the point that matters, right, that exchange, that first touch, that, you know, connection with the front lines, it's all that matters.
So. That's right.
All right. All right. Well, thanks again, Chance.
Okay.